Welcome to episode 49 of Jughead's Basement, featuring the subcategory of The Horror of the Polycephalia-poria. This episode starring punk rock metal singer-songwriter Grim Deeds. The first half of the podcast, he will perform with us as a character in the story, and then the last 20 minutes is an interview with him, which resonates with topics brought up in the horror story. Please, to keep this podcast active, share episodes, make one-time donations through PayPal at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com, or join our Patreon for a couple bucks a month. The info for that is all over the webpage. And lastly, give us a 5-star review or whatever you feel at iTunes or any place you get your podcasts. And now, The Horror of the Polycephalia-poria, Part 3, with recaps of Part 2 by Brian Rooney.
After losing a shouting match with the woman in the floorboards, John and Jason came face to face with Kyle, which was difficult because he didn't have one. A face, that is. While on the stage of a tacky nightclub, John, Jason, and Kyle had a meeting of the minds, which was easy since Kyle was a brain in a jar. A two-headed horror and a disembodied mind had a discussion about hiking, a potential escape route through the laundry chute, and the nature of humor. But is the real joke about to be played on the Polycephalia-poria? We shall find out on this episode of The Horror of the Polycephalia-poria.
Jason and John casually back out of the room, easily unseen by all of the brains, as Kyle continues to speak endlessly with his newfound freedom to honestly offend. Yet it is not a freedom free enough for him to permanently escape just being a brain at an apparently 24-hour imaginary nightclub. The difference now is he will have to fend for himself by actually creating meaningful, impactful, edgy jokes for the rest of eternity. Or else return to the knock-knock and fartless dad jokes that has kept him trapped, but somewhat at ease, bathing not only in formaldehyde, but an ignorance of his own mediocrity.
Seeing how you've taken over all of our limbs, without consulting me first, I might add, you must have an idea as to where we should go next.
Kyle mentioned a laundry chute, and that reminded me that while we were escaping the earthquake scream of that woman in the floor, I peered down another hallway and saw a small, square, door-likey thingy object on one of the walls. That could be what he was talking about.
An actual laundry chute. My God. This building is old. But, good detective work there, John. I'd say you had a good head on your shoulders, but I'd be referring to myself.
When we freed Kyle from his restraints, perhaps we freed him from his spewing of misinformation and confusion. Jason, we may have found our way out.
So we slide down to our freedom, scare all the people around as if we were conjured straight out of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and then attempt, through some magical or scientific means, to separate ourselves.
Funny, 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 funny. One hurdle at a time, Jason.
Hurdle? Hurdle? It's more like a brain with no legs or eyes scaling the Grand Canyon on his way to a voiceover gig. It's going to take an Elizabeth Goddard Harlequin romance novel-like heroism for us to conquer the fucking sheer amount of man versus nature we'll have to face.
I'm sorry. Just try to calm down. Huh. What do you know? Here it is.
On the wall between two empty picture frames is a square door with a rusty hinge that pulls the door upwards and open.
Well, it was a good plan, buddy, but I don't think there is any way a two-headed body such as ours is going to fit down that chute.
Jason and John reach their heads into the chute and look down.
There's definitely something down there for us. I can feel it. Look, you can see a little bit of light all the way down there. Can you see it?
Yes, I can.
We have to try.
Fine. All right.
The Polycephalaporia squeezes itself further into the open shaft in preparation to fall down into an unknown location. A strong gust of wind pushes up against its body, forcing it to fall upward instead of down through the tight-fitted laundry chute. Faster and faster, Jason and John sail upward, bumping their heads and shared arms and shoulders and feet along their painful way. Even though they are falling upwards, they land downwards into an attic. There is an immediate overwhelming of the sense of smell, with too many stenches combined to accurately describe its horridness. They have not escaped, but only gone further up in this suburban labyrinth made of brick and wood. They have landed softly, but moistly, within a homogeneous laundry basket full of filthy socks, shirts, shoes, jackets, coats, handkerchiefs, dirty dishes, and, of course, crusty, satiated undergarments. As they struggle to remove themselves from the moist stench, they hear a voice.
Don't you dare undo what I have done. It is an art to make that which is clean dirty. My process is to be not disturbed, or my name is not Dr. Deeds.
Dr. Deeds?
Indeed. Dr. Grim Deeds, to be precise.
Doctor of what?
Do not displace any of that dirt or filth that surrounds you. That thick splotch on the cardigan near your second head took me 27 hours to shit out.
Oh my god, I'm the second head.
John is so shocked by his proximity to actual shit that he bumps his head against Jason's head, trying to quickly move away.
Ow!
Jason and John carefully and methodically remove themselves from the cornucopia of stench. Looking over at Dr. Deeds, they notice that, even perfectly proportioned for a thin, tall man, he is only 3 feet in height.
He is shockingly short. Are we sure he's a doctor? Doesn't that profession have some kind of height requirement? Like a roller coaster ride?
I used to be short when I had my own body.
While Jason and John remove themselves from the bin and talk about height, Dr. Deeds continues to soil clothes by running in place and wiping a pile of perfectly clean white t-shirts across his sweaty armpits. The yellow stains become instantly apparent and just as odorific. Yet somehow, Deeds remains perfectly clean and fresh as a baby.
Your company is welcomed, but it isn't easy consistently making something from nothing under these ridiculous time constraints, so watch your step. Stains are not as permanent here as one would think. And I only have so much sweat, saliva, and shit in my body.
Did you understand anything he was talking about?
No, and to be honest, I really wasn't expecting to. But I am surprised that he is the sweetest smelling thing I have ever smelled. And I'm on the board for at least 4 botanical gardens, and a member of 5 others. I'm surprised I can enjoy it over the putrid miasma, the rancid, gross stank of this room.
Huh. You're right. He does smell surprisingly beautiful. Like lilacs and honey.
Please, two-headed man, state your business and politely leave me to my work.
What exactly is it you think you are doing here?
Time is of the essence, and we are in imminent danger. When he arrives, I don't know what he will do to you.
Who?
What?
May I tell you in song?
In song? All right, Dr. Deeds. Go ahead.
I choose the genre of punk rock because it is concise and aggressive and rather filthy in temperament. And often infectiously catchy. And I like things to be filthy and infected.
Dr. Grimm drops a well-soiled t-shirt and retrieves a microphone that just happens to be within reach. He picks up a combat boot coated in blood and bombshell dust and whips it across the attic. It hits a big red button on the far wall and triggers huge speakers buried under piles of clothes to hum and hiss into existence. He reaches into a smelly jar of used car oil and smears the black coagulated liquid across his eyes and down his gaunt cheeks. Even before the music begins, Dr. Deed's eccentric brand of pop punk causes the room to vibrate in preparation. He puts the mic to his mouth.
The stench of my darkest secrets lingers like an unwelcome guest. It awakens the beast within me. I can feel his claws tear at my chest. No rest, my sanity arose from all this stress. A scientist beholds the strangers and can't decide who annoys him more. Experiment will investigate their fate when they are joined forevermore. Two heads, one form, a monster to abhor. But why? Smell the stench of my dirty laundry.
Why?
I must clean this wretched mess.
Why?
There's a monster on the loose.
Why?
Scientist has left us both to guess.
Beholds two strangers.
And what scientist?
This sounds more like our story than Dr. Deeds.
Grim Deeds drops the microphone and begins breathing heavily and farting.
Oh my, for the love of St. Pete, can the stank in here get any worse?
It can get worse. It can. Oh my God! He's pulling his sweet-smelling clothes off. How the hell do we get out of this pit of despair?
Oh, never again shall we trust the brain named Kyle. Oh my God! Cut off my nose! Oh.
Ivy, run away! Save yourself! Danger! Danger!
Danger! Don't forget me!
Jason and John begin to run in circles, searching for a way out, kicking up dirty laundry in their way, panicking, scratching and pushing on the attic walls. They see the laundry chute on the ceiling from where they had fallen. They would put each other on each other's shoulders to reach it, but there is only one body and no other body to stack. They look towards Dr. Deeds. Could they stand on him? His skin begins to bubble and burst, fumigating the room in disgusting smells that actually take on form as coloured puke-like smoke screens wafting through the stale air.
Okay, look, here's the plan. We'll run towards him with our nose plugged and launch ourselves off of his back, grab onto the laundry chute and climb our way back up. Or down, or sideways, whatever the fuck. Let's just do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Charge!
Dr. Deeds, now having grown 72 inches, stands at about 9 feet tall. He holds out his furry, dripping, filthy palm towards the polycephalia and stops it dead in its tracks. Jason and John fall to the ground into the pile of yellow, sweat-pitted t-shirt.
Oh, golly. Many apologies. Here, let me help you up.
Oh, your hand smells worse than everything in this room combined.
Oh, it's like a soiled baby's diaper implanted into the stomach of a dead cow that's been sitting out in the sun for 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah, then throw it into a microwave to give it that vaporous, porous smell without boiling away the stench.
It is true. I am so sorry.
The beast that was Deeds picks up a filthy shirt and wipes his nose with it. He inhales the stench and the shirt begins to sparkle.
He's folding the shirt?
Here, can you set this on that table, please? I would graciously appreciate your assistance.
In the corner of the room is the only spotless table in the attic. Jason and John take the shirt from the beast and place it on the immaculately clean surface of the table.
The folding of the corners of this shirt are They're perfectly mastered. Why, he could easily get himself a part-time job at a Benetton or Uniqlo.
But what about his smell? No right-minded boss would hire this beast. We gotta get out of here.
Would you mind helping me some more? I have to have this room cleaned before... I don't even like to think of what happens to me when I change back. You're in danger! You must leave! But no, stay. Please, you must help me clean.
You want us to go, but you want us to stay? Is this some kind of Joe Strummer-inspired riddle?
I know. I'm doing it again. I'm such an imperfect being. I must be bipolar. I need a therapist, but they are hard to find when you are locked in an attic. And I can't fit through that laundry. Shoot.
Hardly locked. There's not even a door.
And the other him is obviously too short to reach that vent. Even standing on a table, I should know. I used to be short. He truly is stuck here.
Please, just grab any filthy item and wipe it on my butt or in my face, and I'll absorb the stains and stench.
Oh, we would love to help, but...
Well, what he's saying is we have our own, problem to solve. We should probably look for this scientist you mentioned in your punk rock song.
What scientist? What punk rock song?
You sang to us. You sang to us a song. Back when you were shorter and smelled much prettier.
Don't lie to me. It hurts when people lie to me. I doubt that other part of me, that beast, I doubt he can sing a tune. But you are right. You should escape this room while you can, before he comes back. He can't be trusted.
Cannot be trusted? But... he smells so sweet.
He cannot be trusted! Get out of here now! I'm tired of both of you. If you are not going to help me clean, then please leave me in peace!
Sorry.
I think I may be obsessive compulsive, but have never been diagnosed.
I'm sorry.
We're both, all one of us, very sorry.
I have work to do!
The beast reaches his arm out. At first, Jason and John are too overwhelmed by the stench to realise what the beast is doing, but then realise that it is inviting them to use his body to climb up to the laundry shaft on the ceiling. They hold their breath and jump onto the beast. This is when they discover that together, breathing together, holding their breath together, they can last longer without air. It causes them no stress at all to climb the beast and hold their breath, reach up to the shaft and pull themselves through the tiny space. 5 minutes without even taking a single breath. As they are forcing their way up, they discover that they are actually climbing down. They reach the top, or bottom, back where they started. They yell into the laundry shaft, Jason yelling up, John yelling down.
Thank you, the beast of Dr. Deeds.
You are very welcome, Polycephaly Emporia.
Oh, not again. What did he call us?
I don't know, and I don't care. Let's just get the fuck out of here.
Things got worse for Katie Morag. Because she was so miserable deep down inside, she was horrible now to the big boy cousins and Agnes. So they were horrible to her. After lunch, there was a terrible squabble on the playground. Katie Morag started it, accused the big boy cousins. You big ones should know how to behave better, said the teacher, exasperated. For your homework, I want you all to work together to find the answers to...
I take it you can hear that voice too?
It sounds like the woman in the floor again. Where's it coming from?
Unless they've replaced my ears with someone else's, I think it's coming from over there. At least I think it is.
A little further down the hall, a door stands open. Claire's voice radiates out from within. Jason and John look into the room. It is a very dingy, sparse, small, claustrophobic room. It is empty except for a single book sitting upon a square wooden table. On the wall hangs a picture frame. There is a piece of glass in the frame, but no images, no photos, no art, and no trace of Claire.
Well, I thought I heard our two-dimensional friend, but look, she's not in the floor.
She's not in the wall or the picture frame either.
The land was white. The seed was black. It will take a good scholar to riddle me that.
In response to Claire's short rhyme, John calls out to the surrounding room.
What does that mean?
It's a riddle.
Where are you?
It's a riddle.
A riddle? Oh, brother.
Well, look on the bright side. At least this room isn't full of things for her to hide behind. Or, in this case, for her to hide in.
While John turns his head left and right, continuing to search the ceiling, walls and floor, Jason picks up the book and opens it randomly.
You found me!
Inside the book is the facade of Claire's face.
You guessed the riddle!
Not really. I just happened to pick up the only object in this entire room.
Oh, you'll never get out of here if you can't solve a riddle properly. Who are you?
We've met before. I'm Jason, and this is John.
You have two names.
We've been through this before.
Do you even remember your name?
Of course I do. It's Katie Morag.
So you're named after this children's book?
I don't think so. But I do very much like this book.
Maybe it was something you read as a child?
Oh, a clue!
Looking at this, I can tell that the book is from Scotland, home of the late Robert Louis Stevenson, whose whimsical pen gave us such delights as Treasure Island, Prince Otto, and the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I must be Scottish!
Which I think may be detected in your bruggish accent.
Definitely a very helpful clue.
For us, or for you?
Maybe both?
Since we're talking about clues, how do we find the scientist?
Ooh, another mystery. Well, here's a riddle.
No, that's okay. I think we'll just move on.
You're in an empty room with just a glass frame and a wooden table. How do we get out?
A glass frame and a wooden table?
The door. We use the door.
No, silly. I didn't say anything about a door.
But there is a door. We used it to get in. That's how we found you in the book.
Not in my riddle! I must be going. I hope you find what you're looking for. Langmuir Limerick. So I am Scottish. What's for you, I'll no go by ye. Oh, that sounds awfu' bonny.
The book wiggles its way out of their arms. The pages begin to flutter. The book, with Claire still inside, lifts up into the air like a lost, demented butterfly. The woman in the book, who has no idea her name is Claire, flutters away towards the door. But since she cannot see where she is going through the fluttering of the pages, she runs into the wall next to the door. The book falls to the floor. Claire's image is now embedded in the wall.
Goodbye.
What's the answer to the riddle? Where's the scientist? Hey, woman in the floor, door, book, where's the scientist?
You look into a mirror, you see what you saw. You take the saw and you cut a table in half. Two halves make a hole, and you climb out of the hole, and there you shall find a scientist.
That is just ridiculous. Is this nonsense from this Katie Morag book as well?
Books don't always have answers, mused Granny Island. Sometimes people know answers better. Now that's a very smart line. Goodbye, Polycephalia Poria.
And with that, once again, Claire disappears.
And once again, she is no help at all. It's not only a stupid riddle, but it's physically impossible.
John glances over their hulking shoulder towards the picture frame.
The glass in that frame is awfully shiny.
Oh, great. Are you losing your mind too? Look, I can't be the only one sane on this body.
The Polycephalia Poria lumbers over to the frame. John is right. The glass is very shiny. They should be able to see their reflection, but they don't.
You look into the mirror, and you see what you saw.
Wait, what? How is that possible? I don't believe it. I just don't believe it.
Thank you for listening to episode 49 of Jughead's Basement, featuring the horror of the Polycephalia Poria, starring Grim Deeds and reoccurring characters John Jughead, Jason Strange, Steve Ball, and Claire Hall. Tune in next episode, where we will be joined by Gwendolyn and Lucy of Dog Party. And now for our interview with Grim Deeds. But I was thinking, even in regards to the episode we just did, I talk about dirty laundry, and I thought about you and Jason in this, because you explore so many different topics in your songs, and it's about people, it's about genres, mm-hmm. and you know, Jason works at a company where he does gossip for like mainstream stars and stuff. So my question to you is, what do you believe in your work or in general? What is the difference to you between, or even the similarities between gossip, criticism, and satire?
That's a great question. What I try to address in the songs is thinking in terms of what makes me personally feel insecure and what makes other people generally feel insecure, because gossip isn't really juicy unless it evokes some kind of uh-oh kind of response in people, where they feel like their guard has been let down or they've been taken off guard, that you're getting to something personal that they're not comfortable with, that you're getting to something that could bring them shame. And shame is like a pretty important theme to my work overall, because part of what I do has been described as shame attacking by a friend of mine who's a psychologist. And it's kind of an exercise in confronting your shame by projecting it and launching it out into the atmosphere where everyone can kind of ruminate in it and then explore it and decide if they can relate to it or not. And my hope is that people will. But I think with gossip and criticism and satire, it's interesting because as an artist, you're already always vulnerable to gossip and criticism, but you have to be brave enough to go for it and to risk whatever type of satire you can get away with, you know, even at the risk of being ridiculed for it or criticized for it. And I think my approach is to be so heavy-handed in my satire that it takes people aback and they may not have time to react to it, almost in the same way that, like, if you sucker punch someone, it kind of puts them on their heels and they're not immediately prepared to respond. So I kind of try to dig for topics that evoke that sort of feeling in people.
I see your stuff as very satirical. I mean, and it's very smart. And the reason you gave a different answer for the gossip than I you actually consider yourself more gossip than I thought. But have you ever felt that you've taken it too far, where it became like, oh, this is just me being mean or personal? And that's what I meant by the satire. Satire is what holds that, you know, more of a social comment, even though you're talking about a single person or something, you know.
There's a song that I've revisited and thought about in that sort of light of like, was this successful as satire, or was it misunderstood, or is it kind of self-serving? And my fear is that it's too self-serving. It's a song I did called I Can't Listen to NOFX, which is a song that can be taken many ways. And one of the ways it can be taken is as a tribute to NOFX, because the song sounds like I was purposefully trying to make it sound like NOFX and deliver it as if it were a NOFX song to show that I'm a fan of NOFX, which is true. And also to make the point that, like, it would be super lame to create a song that's a tribute to NOFX and make it like a praiseworthy, you know, like praising them and saying, oh, look how cool they are. Yeah, they're a really cool band. And Fat Mike creates really great songs. And you're like, that would just be so lame. So I turned it around and just totally talked shit throughout the entire song and tried to hit all of their Achilles heels, like their fame, their disregard for their fans, their sort of ambivalent attitude towards their success and their kind of half-assed approach to performances and their reveling in their own, you know, bullshit, you know, a lot of the time it seems like. But at the same time, I can't deny that they're a huge influence on me, and I'm a huge fan of their albums and his songwriting specifically. And, you know, if I'm honest, he's someone who I would want acknowledgement for my stuff probably more so than most of my heroes. The song can come across also as kind of a self-serving, you know, hitting below the belt kind of thing, where I'm just seeking attention. And I didn't intend for it to be that, but I can totally see, like, I've read the YouTube comments where people are like, oh, well, he's just pissing and moaning about this band because his band's not as good or as successful. And yeah, maybe that there is some truth to that. And that's the uncomfortable part of the satire, is investigating, like, what made me insecure enough to want to write the song in the first place, you know? Yeah.
The amount of prolific you are, and in general, like I learned from the Neo Futurists, like
you start really putting out raw stuff that's amazing, but then you also end up questioning yourself more afterwards.
Oh, sure.
Instead of putting that beforehand, so you're not being too critical of yourself and allowing it to come out. It makes sense to have a little bit of, I wouldn't even say regret, but like questioning your motives and stuff.
My compass for my own motives and sort of my litmus test for whether something is sincere enough or whether it's too self-serving, it kind of boils down to, am I really trying to start a conversation? I don't want to be just showing off. You know, I don't want to just say like, yeah, look at me, or like, you know, the cool factor is not what I'm going for. It's more about, here's a topic, let's face it together. It's uncomfortable, but it could be addressed. And like, if we're brave enough, we can do that together.
Like many people in the music scene, you sort of create your own different persona. Do you consider that a part or a different person? And do you ever get confused with that? Or do you get confused with people's relationship to it or your statements about you?
The same friend of mine who described my work as like shame attacking also described the character of Grim Deeds as an avatar for human suffering. I might as well shout him out, by the way. It's my friend Vincent. He goes by Jason V from the band The Jasons, which is also a very satirical band, a good friend of mine, a great band, full of humor and full of intelligence as well. That's where that came from. But to your question, my goal for the Grim Deeds persona and character is to take something dark, the darkness of human nature, the darkness of satanic imagery, evil intentions, universally reviled as being bad and evil and distasteful, but delivering it with humor and delivering it like you could present it to a child and the child wouldn't be afraid because it's obviously silly. And I will take the band Gwar was very successful in incorporating like brutal themes of barbarians, you know, beheading one another, but also cracking jokes and making it silly and funny, yet still there was some substance to the aesthetic of it. So I want to have some aesthetic substance. And it's also kind of my almost a reaction against what's very typical in the pop punk world, which is to kind of color within the lines and make everything nice and neat and fit the same archetypes that have been well established over many decades. But I also know there are plenty of pop punkers who love heavy metal, who like to skate, who are weird, who appreciate strange humor, and their mind can color outside the lines. So that's kind of what I attempt to do with the Grim Deeds character, is to present this figure that represents all of the raw emotion that goes into my songs, but also all of the humor that you, and if you know me as a person, you know that I'm a pretty lighthearted guy. You know, I try to, you know, make people feel comfortable when they're around me, and the dark parts of myself are secret until they're revealed in the form of Grim Deeds.
Whether it's in your character or the circumstances now of the quarantine, you in general don't play out as much. So your character becomes more of your like internal stuff that you deal with a lot more on your own, but you have performed live.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you experience this as much as someone like a Ben Weasel or a Fat Mike might experience, but do you feel like you've incorporated that person into yourself?
I'll be honest. There was a point in which I was suffering from depression, and Grim Deeds, a lot of the songs that I was writing were exploring some very dark feelings and very fatalistic ways of thinking about my life. And then it kind of developed into this momentum where I felt like those are the only type of songs that I could and should be writing. And that was kind of a daunting realization, because I didn't only want to write songs that made me feel worse. You know? So what ended up happening is I actually began to pursue different courses of therapy to change my way of thinking. One of the ways was through cognitive behavioral therapy and adjusting sort of my mindset around how I digest things, how I think about the emotions that I feel, and how to kind of reframe them in a way that is sustainable for my life. And when I did that, I realized, well, you know, I don't have to write songs like that necessarily. And I actually began writing songs for other side projects just for the express purpose of doing fun music for its own sake. But then I returned to the Grim Deeds, because Grim Deeds is also my outlet, as you've noted, for like satire, commenting on current events, current social trends, things that I noticed that are specifically going on in the pop punk world. And, you know, that's still always going to be fresh. But the downer stuff started to become a heavy burden for me at a certain point, and I had to kind of relieve myself of that burden by exploring other, you know, other ways of dealing with life, which then led to other ways of expressing myself through the songs.
I'm going to hand it over to Jason.
Excellent.
I want to touch back on this term shame attacking. Do you see shame as something that's positive or negative?
I think it's mostly negative, because what it signifies to me, at least my own personal experience dealing with shame, is that you are dwelling in a place that no longer exists, and you're dwelling on a part of yourself that is no longer the current you. And so shame is kind of a reflection of your inability to forgive yourself and to move on with your life, which can be very difficult. And it's also very tempting to dwell in that world. It's almost like a pleasurable form of pain, because it's so familiar and you can kind of rehash those details over and over again. But, you know, like almost like a drug, it can get to a point where it starts to take negative effect. So my relationship with shame has evolved a lot over the past probably 10 years. And I don't dwell so much on my mistakes of the past, but they're still there. And I think it's important to know that they're there and to reflect on them. I think that shame can be shaped into something positive if you're willing to work on it in that way, and to use it as an opportunity to grow, be reflective about it instead of just indulging in it.
I was curious, because like, I think we've seen over the last couple of years, shame as like a public tool, I don't know, sort of lose a little bit of its potency. There have been social movements to sort of call out disgusting behaviors, mm-hmm. and instigate some kind of change. But then you also see certain, we'll just say like politicians, mm-hmm. who get called out for hypocritical behavior and they shrug it off. So mm-hmm. is shame something that's just being relegated more towards like a personal thing? Or do you think it has like a place in society?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, in the context of cancel culture, I think it's being used as a tool, an effective tool to smear people and to ruin their reputations and to take the wind out of their sails. And that's a pretty cruel tactic, personally, because it encourages us to emphasize all the worst moments in a person's life, which is ultimately one that's very complex and filled with ups and downs and filled with mistakes that can be redeemed. But we don't see the follow-up story with the redemption. Usually we're only left to dwell in the sensational headlines, going back to like the gossip. It's like, ooh, you know, like, look at that. And then you kind of savor that, because I think there's some part of us that is resentful about celebrities and people who may or may not think that they're better than us. But I think in order to really to feel shame, you have to know that you did something wrong and be willing to admit it, at least to yourself. And one of our big issues, I think, as a culture is being able to be okay with not being right. And it's almost an obsession in America. Rather than be right, attack the other side. Rather than be right, become the enemy of the one who disagrees with you. But I'm reading a book right now, Summer with Montaigne. Montaigne was this French politician / philosopher in the 1600s. And one of the points he makes is that when you're in a dialogue with someone, you should invite them to correct you if you're wrong. And you should be eager to be wrong in that sense, because you're improving your understanding of the world and yourself. And you have to be able to train yourself to not take those things personally, to not see it as an attack on your ego. And as Americans, I think we all, you know, are kind of prone to having that conflict between our egos and our greater sense of purpose and morality, and conflict between the United States as a Christian nation and the United States as having like this huge ego. And we can only always be right. Or if we're not right, then we're just going to say, fuck you to the other side, you know, and instead of saying, oh, well, maybe I'm wrong and maybe I could reflect on that and maybe I could listen for once and try to learn something. I do think a lot about this issue of how important is it really to be right, and how important is it really to get the last word in and to have the final boom chicka wow wow performance.
In our conversation, we've talked about negotiating differences between mm-hmm. egos and morality, and mm-hmm. since we in the story find you airing dirty laundry, and the mention of I call him my alter ego's, his day job with celebrity gossip, I was curious, was there any time that you learned a certain fact or like tidbit about a celebrity, an artist, or a famous figure that completely changed your attitude towards them? Like, did you learn? And I mean, learning that someone is like a sexual predator, like that, I think kind of like I'm just going to presume that's sort of like the default. Like, I imagine you're not really a huge Harvey Weinstein fan anymore, if ever.
Right.
But like, is there any, in your past, is there any case of like never meet your heroes, or even if it's something positive, like figuring out that Vin Diesel is a huge Dungeons and Dragons dork?
Yeah, that's a very endearing example. I remember reading that and thinking that was super cool. But I'm very steeped in the lore of heavy metal, which includes the Norwegian black metal scene. And there were a lot of murders and church burnings and, you know, very infamous cases of metal musicians doing bad things. The art that was created by some of these musicians still stands today as extremely influential and very unique, enjoyable and interesting pieces of art. So I think my kind of position on that has been that artists are kind of a conduit of ideas. I do tend to separate the aspects of the art that I find inspiring from the actual person who created it. I remember there was a big controversy around Michael Jackson when that, I think it was like a, maybe it was an HBO film or some kind of straight to streaming film that interviewed people that he allegedly wronged and molested and stuff like that. And there was this big public outcry about like, should you ever listen to his music again? And they interviewed Louis Theroux about, you know, what would you do? And he said, oh, I'd probably give it a little time, but yeah, I'd probably end up going back and listening to the music because it's great music. It's undoubtedly, you know, some of the most iconic pop music ever made. And people weren't satisfied with that because I think a lot of times people, when they're in that mode of being up in arms, you know, it becomes a witch hunt. And in the witch hunt, you're not supposed to ever forgive the witch. The witch is irredeemable. The witch is to be sacrificed. And I think that's kind of like the mindset that people have in those situations. There have been other scenarios, like you said, with pedophilia and like molesting of children and stuff. It's unforgivable acts morally. But can we still have compassion for people who do horrible things? Like, apparently you're supposed to if you're a Christian or if you're someone who has a moral philosophy that includes forgiveness at all, but it's not an easy thing to do. And it's much easier to point the finger and say, look at this awful example of a human being. And since they did this one thing or whatever that they're now infamous for, that proves that their entire life can only be summed up by that. And why take a closer look at all their other contributions that might be worthy or whatever potential they have to redeem themselves later, you know? That bothers me a lot. I mean, I'm a teacher too. I'm a public school teacher. So that's a whole genre of headlines in itself. Like, teacher says horrible thing in class and it's video recorded or, you know, shoved a student or, and it's something that's on my mind a lot. I forgive, but I still acknowledge the mistakes.
It means you can still listen to Burzum.
Yeah, that he's a great example. I mean, I think Varg is crazy, personally. I think a lot of the stuff he says makes not a lot of sense politically or philosophically or even is very reasonable, but he was a pioneer of a sound that has endured, that has inspired many, and he's a creative guy who I relate to what he did with Burzum as a project. I don't relate to the murder of Euronymous. I don't relate to white nationalism and weird isolationist views that he has, but I'll still listen to his albums. Yeah.
It's good to learn how to separate the monster from the man.
Very well said.
Thank you everybody for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share, write reviews, and join our Patreon team for a few bucks a month. It makes a big difference. Thanks again. Goodbye.